Alright guys, you are locked on Falcons. I am your host, Aaron Freeman, and today I am giving my reaction to the Falcons' Day 2 selections in the 2018 NFL Draft of Colorado cornerback Isaiah Oliver, as well as South Florida defensive tackle Deidre Sinhamite.
You are locked on Falcons, your daily podcast on the Atlanta Falcons, part of the Locked On Podcast Network. Your team, every day.
All right, guys, you know me. I'm Aaron Freeman, founder of FalFans.com, one of the longest-running Falcon websites on the internet. Of course, on Twitter, at FalFans, tipping the picks. You can also find me hosting this illustrious Locked On Falcons podcast. And so today we're going to recap day two. Went a lot better, at least in terms of I could see the plan. In comparison to day one, if you missed my day one recap episode where I talked about the Falcons selection of Calvin Ridley, go check that out. That was up yesterday, and it took me a while to process. And, you know, before we get to the Oliver and Sinhamite picks, you know, if you followed me on Twitter on Friday, you probably saw me slowly begin to process the Ridley pick over the course of 4 or 5 hours in the morning and early afternoon. And I was eventually able to sort of wrap my head around it. I'm still not like enthusiastically in love with the pick, and I'll certainly discuss this more, but I get it, you know, I get it. And I think it could wind up working out very well for the Falcons if certain things click into place, and we'll sort of see how that stuff sort of plays out over the next 2 to 3 years. And if it does, and, you know, as I said on yesterday's episode, no one's going to care that this was a quote-unquote questionable pick, depending on your perspective, obviously. I know that's not a universally held thought on the Ridley pick. Similar to Keanu Neal and Desmond Trufant and Algie Crumpler. I know that's before a lot of y'all's time, but I just remember the Crumpler pick was not a very popular pick at the time, given how much the Falcons had invested in tight end positions of the four previous drafts with Reggie Kelly and O.J. Santiago, even though Crumpler was way better than either of those two guys. But that's a tangent for another day. Let's talk about Isaiah Oliver first. He was a second-round pick, good value pick. Basically, in a nutshell, the reason why I like this Oliver pick is he replaces Jalen Collins. And the difference is, unlike Jalen Collins, he's not a knucklehead. Good, high-character guy, much more polished cornerback. But this was a need for the Falcons. And, you know, a lot of people looked at the cornerback position and didn't understand the need. And I think, from my perspective, this was, to me, outside of D-tackle, and then when they took guard off the table with the signing of Fusco, this was the biggest need they had on the roster this year. This offseason, I should say. Because when you look at the depth of the team, even though they re-signed Bleedy Ray Wilson, even though they picked up Justin Bethel, and even though Brian Poole is a solid nickel cornerback for the team, you know, the potential sort of devastation that would be wrought by the Falcons losing Desmond Trufant and Robert Alford, even for a brief period of time, would be much bigger than I think people realize, because one of the issues that the Falcons face is they rely so heavily, particularly this past season, and it was even more stark in 2016 down the stretch once Dan Quinn took over the play calling and how much they relied on man coverage. But this season, you know, they mixed in a lot more zone with their cover three looks. But they still, when push comes to shove on third downs, they're manning up teams. They're playing man coverage. And the problem would have been, had you had an injury to Trufant or Alford, you wouldn't have had a guy that can do that. We saw this last season in the Vikings game, right? The thing about the Vikings game where Bleedy Ray Wilson was playing for Trufant and Poole was injured as well. And so I think C.J. Goodwin got a lot of reps that week as well. What you saw in that game was the Falcons playing pretty much exclusively cover three zone in that game to essentially hide Bleedy Ray Wilson, as well as there are the corners. But we saw late in that game where C.J. Goodwin was lined up on a critical third down or a fourth down or whatever it was against Adam Thielen. They went to man coverage and he got beat, and you know, ultimately probably contributed to his being cut. And so what happens is, if you have a twisted ankle or you have a pulled hammy here or there from Alford or Trufant, and you're forced to play Bethel, you're forced to play B.W. Wilson, you can't play that way anymore. I mean, you just simply can't do it. And the reality is, Poole is not a great man corner. He's a really good zone corner. He's an outstanding zone corner. But in terms of man coverage, he's functional to competent somewhere on that scale. You know, and really sort of depends on the matchup. You know, against a guy like Nelson Aguilar, he's more functional. Against a guy like Jarvis Landry, he's probably a little bit closer to competent, if not good. But it's one of those things where you look at the situation, and the Falcons needed a big corner that could play man coverage. And that's what Isaiah Oliver is. They needed another guy. That's not Justin Bethel. That's not Bleedy Ray Wilson. That's not Brian Poole. And that's Isaiah Oliver. And that's what I mean when it's like, we needed to replace Jalen Collins. And it was one of the reasons why, you know, make fun of me all I want, but it was one of the reasons why, like, I was pushing for the Falcons to keep Jalen Collins or give him another chance. And obviously he blew that. But that's why. It was a need. And when they cut C.J. Goodwin, and when they got rid of Deji Olatoye last year, it was like, yeah, we definitely need a guy with size because we don't have that. Like, Pleady Wilson's not a small guy. Trufant's not a small guy. Justin Bethel's not a small corner. But none of these guys are sort of ideally suited other than Trufant, obviously. But even then, we've seen Trufant struggle with the big receivers, like a Mike Evans, like a Mike Thomas, like a Kelvin Benjamin over the years. These 6'3", 6'4", 6'5" wide receivers are going to give a guy who's like 6 foot and an eighth of an inch a lot of problems. And we saw that last year. We saw Thomas give Alford a lot of fits in those Saints games. Now the Saints, with the selection of Tre'Quan Smith, who's a 6'2" guy out of UCF, with the addition of Cameron Meredith, who's a 6'3" guy, they have a trio of receivers now. They're 6'2" or above across the board. You got a 6'5" Mike Evans. You got Josh Gordon, A.J. Green, and Alshon Jeffrey, and Jock Stocks, and all these guys are 6'2", 6'3", or taller. You know, you got Larry Fitzgerald, who's a slot receiver, who's a 6'3" guy. You got Tyler Boyd, 6'2", playing the slot this year. You got Juju Smith-Schuster, who's, you know, probably going to play a lot of slot this year for the Steelers, 6'1". And you got those guys. Poole's going to be matching up against those guys, like at 5'9" and a half or whatever he is, 5'9" and 3/8". Like, that's not a favorable matchup for him, especially in man coverage. You know, I don't know. Like, you know, again, not to dump on Poole because I think he's a very valuable role player, but I think asking him to go up against some of those slot receivers that we're going to see, not let alone those guys, but the Jarvis Landrys, the Nelson Aguilars, the Randall Cobbs of the world, the Sterling Shepherds, in addition to those bigger slots. And then if you have an injury, all of a sudden now you're putting Bleedy Ray Wilson on Mike Thomas, Bleedy Ray Wilson on A.J. Green. Like, come on. Like, that's not conducive to success, is it? So and a guy like Oliver comes in with his 6'2" size, or 6'1" size, or whatever it is. I probably should have looked that up before I recorded, right? Okay, he's only 6'1¼". So I thought he was a little taller than that. He looks taller than that. But here's the point where it matters. While Oliver is not a 6'2" corner like I was thinking in my head, he's long because he's got 33.5-inch arms, which is in the 97th percentile for arm length as far as cornerbacks go. So he plays bigger. You know, he plays like a 6'2" corner, even though he's only 6 feet. And so getting a guy like that and adding him to the Falcons secondary, so now that you're 4 deep at cornerback, hopefully with Casey stepping up, you're 3 deep at safety, in addition to Poole's ability to dabble at both. And so you have this, you know, you have this 7-man secondary that all of a sudden now you can start playing dime looks. You can start being like, we don't need to play nickel. We can play dime against certain teams that we're going to face this year. Like when we play the Giants this year and they got Evan Engram, who's essentially a wide receiver that quote unquote is a tight end. All of a sudden it's like, oh, let's play some dime against those guys. Because we're really playing against, when they go to their 11 personnel, it's really 10 personnel. It's four wide receiver set. And so let's put four cornerbacks on the field to cover these four wide receivers. Right? So that's the flexibility that you want to have defensively. You want to have that depth. You want to have that flexibility defensively so that against certain teams, you can get into advantageous matchup situations. You're not forced to try to square peg situations. So I think the Oliver pick is a really smart pick for the Falcons in a nutshell. I have no complaints about it. I like the pick a lot. I think, you know, I wasn't quite as high on Oliver as other people that were saying, like, he's a first round pick. If the Falcons had taken him at 26, I wouldn't have been upset with the pick. I saw him more as a early to mid second round guy, top 50 guy, certainly. My one real issue with him was more sort of like just a little bit more refinement on his technique and some questions about his long speed that against if you're putting him on up against a guy like Antonio Brown or Ted Ginn, I don't know if that's really the matchup that you're looking for, you know? So, but I think having a guy with his length, his size, his length, his physicality, his athleticism, I think it's going to be big for the Falcons moving forward. I think it gives them a legitimate Robert Alford heir apparent. You know, Alford's going to be 30 in November. Next season, the Falcons could, if they wanted to, move on from him. They could free up almost $8 million in cap space by cutting Alford next offseason. Not saying that that's going to happen. But, you know, I look at it like Alford's playing style is he's more of a less of a refinement guy and more of an athlete guy. So I do think you're not necessarily going to expect him to be playing at a high level, you know, beyond age 30 or 31. That's my expectation. Past experience has taught me that, but he could certainly be the exception to that. And so, you know, I do think now having a guy in Oliver that you can sort of stash on your roster that gives you immediate value as a matchup corner, but also gives you long-term value as a guy that, you know, a year from now or 2 years from now or 3 years from now could wind up starting on the outside, that you're not getting in Bleedy Ray Wilson. You're not getting in Justin Bethel. You're not getting in Leon McFadden. And you're not getting in Brian Poole. Right? If Brian Poole's going to start as a true starter somewhere and not just a nickel starter, if he's going to be a starter for an every down player, it's probably going to be at safety, not cornerback. Right? And again, I'm not suggesting that Brian Poole is going to replace Ricardo Allen anytime soon. I'm just saying he could. I'm just saying, like, if there was a position where we're going to see Brian Poole start playing, pulling, you know, 98% of the snaps, it would probably be safety, not cornerback. So I think this is a great pick for the Falcons. I don't really have anything else to say. Good pick. Yeah. So before we move on to Deidre and Sinat, since we're talking draft, you guys got to check out Locked On NFL Draft Podcast, as well as the Locked On NFL Podcast with host Matt Williamson and Locked On NFL, host Trevor Sikkema, John Ledyard on Locked On NFL Draft, part of Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day. So let's talk about Deidre and Sinat. I think this is a good pick. I really do. I dig it a lot because looking at all the D tackles that were going in round three, I was like, other than Nathan Shepard, and, you know, PJ Hall went late in the second round. But, like, other than those two guys, like, I think I probably would have preferred Deidre and Sinat over any of the other guys that got picked, like BJ Hill and Justin Jones. Harrison Phillips got picked a couple picks after Sinat. I think you can make a case that Phillips was better than Sinat, but other, you know, I'm not going to necessarily, that's splitting hairs in my eyes. I like Sinat a lot. I think he's a good player. I think, you know, he's going to play that one technique role. You know, I didn't expect the Falcons to take a one tech this early in the draft, but I think sort of because of the run of D tackles early in the round three, I think it sort of forced their hand and they couldn't necessarily afford to see who was going to be available there at pick 126. And they sort of took the guy that was probably in their eyes the best of the bunch. I know, a lot of people are going to sit here and be like, what about Maurice Hurst? What about Maurice Hurst? I was inundated with like 7,000 mentions on Friday. Be like, what about Hurst and this? And well, the Falcons going to take Hurst? Are they going to take him here in round two? Are they going to take him in round three? Or when are they going to take Hurst? And it's like, you know, guys, you got to read context clues, man. You know, I don't know anything. I can only speculate, but pretty much everything we've heard about Maurice Hurst seems to strongly suggest that the Falcons aren't going to take him. They've had three opportunities to draft him. They haven't drafted him. Everything that people like Mayock and McShay and D-Led are saying about the Falcons or NFL teams in general's interest for some of those guys, and then D-Led coming in with the Falcons' specific interests, suggests that most teams in the league have taken Maurice Hurst off their boards because of whatever the heart condition that he has. So it's one of those things where I think at this point in time, expecting the Falcons to take him is probably a pipe dream. Look, I won't say there's no shot of it. Maybe the Falcons intended to say, okay, well, if he falls around four, we'll take him. Maybe they made that decision, you know, last week or something like that. I doubt it, but like that's certainly a possibility. But it's one of those things where it's like, I think that ship has sort of sailed. That's my guess. I think if they were planning on taking Maurice Hurst, they would have done so by now. That's what I think. But, you know, then so excusing Maurice Hurst out of the equation, I think they probably looked at a guy like Sanat and said, he's the best D-tackle left. One tech. You know, I don't think this means, oh, well, Grady Jarrett's going to be the three. Well, what it means is, right, and we need to be clear about this. The whole one technique versus the three technique stuff only really matters in the base defense. Because when you go to the nickel sub package, both D tackles are pretty much playing three tech because that's the most advantageous pass rushing stance. And the difference between the D tackles is really left D tackle and right D tackle, depending on what side of the defensive line you play on, rather than your quote unquote technique. Because by and large, you're just going to play a three technique or you're going to play over the guard or whatever the case may be. So the whole one tech versus three tech only really matters in the base defense. And early last season, the Falcons primarily had Grady Jarrett playing one tech, and then they had Poe playing three tech. So in base downs, when you would see Poe and Jarrett out there, it was almost always Jarrett at the one and Poe at the three. Most of the time, not every time, but most of the time, vast majority of the time. Then when they picked up Ataba Rubin midway through the season, and they started mixing him into the base defense, what they would do is put Rubin at the one and then put Jarrett at three. So essentially what Deidre Sanat's going to do is he's going to replace Ataba Rubin. The Falcons have yet to acquire their Don Terry Poe replacement so far. Maybe they get that later in the draft. I'm not overly optimistic about that because I think the three techs that are left available are whatever, but I'll discuss that towards the end of the episode. So essentially what Sanat's going to be is he's going to be our Rubin replacement, and probably in the base defense, he's going to play the one technique. Dan Quinn's already sort of confirmed this, calling him a nose tackle, which is what a one technique is. You know, so if one tech is a 4-3 nose tackle, essentially. So he's going to play that role. Jarrett's going to probably play the three in the base. And what you're going to probably see for the Falcons this year is when the Falcons go to their nickel sub package, barring some significant addition between now and September, which could happen in draft, which could happen free agent, which could happen in training camp. But I wouldn't necessarily bet on it at this point. The guy that's going to line up beside Grady Jarrett in the nickel sub package, which is going to be on the field for 65% of the snaps, is probably going to be Jack Crawford. So basically the Falcons have a lot more confidence in Jack Crawford's ability than probably most Falcon fans, including myself, do. But we'll see how it goes. It's coming off a biceps or a triceps injury, so it shouldn't necessarily negatively affect him too much. But if you want to get an idea of sort of what Sanat brings to the table, you go back and listen to the Vita Vea episode that we had with John Oney. He talked about Sanat in that episode, and he's really sort of more like, you know, I've seen a lot of people sort of compare him to Grady Jarrett. I don't think that's a really good comparison. There are similarities between them, but it's not really, you know, it's like comparing Vince Wilfork and Geno Atkins. Like, Grady Jarrett's more Geno Atkins, Deidre Sanat's more Vince Wilfork, but because they're both short and squat, you know, people are going to be like, oh, well, they're similar. I don't really agree there. You know what I'm saying? Like, that's what I'll say. So I think Sanat is more of a poor man's Vince Wilfork, you know, if you're going to, you know, talk about what he brings to the table and his playing style. Very productive, you know, 10 and a half, I think, tackles for loss last year, six sacks, around those numbers. That could be off by half, give or take a half sack or something, or half tackle for loss. Pro Football Focus had him ranked as their number two highest in terms of run stop percentage this past season, only behind Harrison Phillips. He squats almost 700. He benches over 500, I think. Yeah, I mean, he's a powerful guy that pushes the pocket. He's not going to be a great pass rusher. I know you're going to see some videos of people retweeting stuff that show him sort of in one-on-one drills in the East-West Shrine game, whooping guys in pass rushing drills. That's not really what he's going to, I don't think that's really what he's going to do, but he can provide some pressure. He showed that at times, but I don't necessarily imagine we're going to have Dejan Sanat out there on third downs being like, okay, you go up against, I don't know, Zach Martin and beat him. I don't think that's really what he's going to do. And so therefore he's not really going to be this high level nickel guy, you know. So he's basically a two down defender, but a good two down defender, and certainly better than a certain nose tackle from NC State that for whatever reason people were just absolutely in love with. I think, you know, I can only surmise because he ran a good 40 and he played at NC State. And so when people were watching that one guy that got drafted by the Broncos by the name Bradley Chubb, they just, you know, saw that guy make a couple of plays. They're like, he's really good and overrated how good he is, but by, you know, osmosis or something like that. So, you know, I know some of you are like, why are you always hating on B.J. Hill? But it's like, it's not that I hate on B.J. Hill. It's just baffling to me to sort of see this groundswell of people in the last month or so just sort of talking about B.J. Hill being this top 50, top 60, top 75 player. And I'm like, really? Like, you know, he's a two-down player. Sanat's a two-down player. Sanat's a better two-down player than B.J. Hill is. Sanat's more powerful. He's more disruptive. He's more productive. He's got a better motor, you know. He's probably better conditioned, you know. Like, he checks every box better than B.J. Hill, and I don't understand. No one's talking about Dejan Sanat being the top 50 pick, but people are talking about B.J. Hill as one, and I'm just baffled by it. But that's my issue with like, you know, like, you watch the Senior Bowl and like he's the backup behind Justin Jones. Like, no one talks about Justin Jones, his teammate, who was a much, much more productive pass rusher and, you know, marginally less productive run defender, I guess. So I don't get it, but you know, B.J. Hill's somewhere. I don't even remember who picked him. Let me look that up so I can make fun of that team. I think the Giants got him or something. Yeah, the Giants got him. I don't know why you're drafting B.J. Hill when you have Damon Harrison, but, like, to each their own, man. I guess you need to have two nose tackles, right? You know, I don't get that at all, but it's the Giants. I look forward to, you know, Alex Mack whooping B.J. Hill this year, I guess. I don't know. So, you know, I'll touch a little bit upon my expectations for day three in a bit. But you guys, if you want to check out all the latest on the Locked On Podcast Network, you can go to LockedOnSports.com, where you can find NFL takes, NBA takes, and MLB takes. You know, this is a busy time of year. You got NBA playoffs, so if you too focused on the draft and you want to quickly catch up on what's going on in the NBA, go to LockedOnSports.com, part of Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day. So, you know, we'll wrap this thing up here, guys. My expectations for day three, I don't really have much. I think at some point they'll take a linebacker. I don't know if they're going to take Maurice Hurst. I know half of you guys listening to the show are going to tweet me tomorrow being like, let me mess with Aaron by asking him about Maurice Hurst, because he got 6,000 mentions yesterday asking him about Maurice Hurst. And then half of you are legitimately going to ask me about Maurice Hurst. Like, what do you think about Maurice Hurst? I'm like, oh my God, why are we talking about Maurice Hurst? We're not drafting Maurice Hurst. Look, be clear. Like, it's just one of those things where it's like, let me rephrase reiterate what I was talking about earlier. It's like, I think Marie Turse is the best D tackle in this class. I don't think it's a conversation. If it was up to me, would I draft him? Absolutely. You know? But it's not up to me. And it's one of those things where it's like, it's way beyond my pay grade to be making these million-dollar decisions about a player that has apparently a serious heart condition, according to some doctors. And according to other doctors, they don't think he has a serious heart condition. But apparently certain doctors may think are sort of lukewarm on the issue and are lukewarm enough that it forces teams to want to mitigate their risk to the maximum extent by not drafting him early in the draft, where they can draft players that in their eyes may not be as good, may not have as much potential and talent, but, you know, certainly are sure things, quote unquote, sure things in terms of what they can contribute. Like, is that my decision? Not really, but like, that's what NFL teams think. We see this time and time again where, you know, 2 years ago, how many years ago it was, Lael Collins, because the incident that he had prior to the draft, he went undrafted and everybody was sitting there saying, hey, man, we should take Lael Collins. When are we going to take Lael? You know, it's the same thing. It happens every year in draft to somebody. Somebody falls and everybody's like, why aren't we taking this guy? And so, like, I don't know, man. I hope we do, but at the same time, like, I'm not holding my breath hoping it's going to happen because I think that ship has sailed, but we'll see. But in terms of day three expectations, right now I think they'll probably take a linebacker. Other than that, I don't really know. You know, this has been the story of this draft offseason with the Falcons draft plans. It's like hashtag who knows is my mantra. It's like, you know, they could fill running back three, they could fill fullback, they could take another D tackle, they could take a backup defensive end to Derek Shelby and ask that guy to push Jack Crawford as the quote unquote nickel interior pass rusher. You know, they need multiple linebackers, at least two, to sort of fill depth spots there. They need a backup strong safety. Not to mention, they could take a third string quarterback. They could take another tight end that could push Saubert and Logan Paulson. They could take an offensive tackle that could push Sam Brelo or Austin Pastore. They could take a guard that can be in the mix there as well. So, you know, they have a lot of options. So I do think there's a decent chance that the Falcons decide to trade back, given that they only have, what, like 4 picks left? And they're not going to be able to fill all those spots with 4 picks. And, you know, they're looking that they're going to have to rely heavily on either being a little bit more proactive after the draft and free agency or in undrafted free agency, which kind of explains maybe why a lot of their visits, or it seemed like a higher percentage of their visits this year, were for late round, 7th round guys, undrafted sort of guys than most years. Yeah, I don't know what's going to happen, guys. That's why I'm sitting here. I'm throwing out all the possibilities, and if one of them happens to be semi-right, I'll sit here and claim how much of a prophet I am for accurately predicting it. But, you know, basically, my quote-unquote genius is just throwing stuff at the wall, and hopefully something sticks. I mean, that's basically what it is. So I'm going to wrap it up here. I am exhausted, if you can't tell by the sound of my voice. It's been a long weekend. It's like 6+ hours tomorrow again, and then another podcast for Monday, and then Sunday, Sunday, another podcast that's going to be posted. Yeah, man, I can't even, my brain is not even functioning anymore. So we got day three recap on Sunday. And then we got the whole draft recap on Monday. And if you want to get my sort of revised Calvin Ridley assessment, we'll probably talk about it certainly on Monday and probably a little bit on Sunday, given who I will be getting for that Sunday episode. I'm sure we will talk about it. So, until then, guys.
You are Locked On Falcons, your daily Atlanta Falcons podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network. Your team every day.
Get out of here, lady. That's so weird, man. Alexa just woke up, ghosted me.
I'm having trouble connecting to the internet.
Shut up. Shut up, Alexa.
I'm having trouble connecting to the internet.
She just ghosted me. All right, that's a fun. We haven't had an outtake in a while, so hopefully, maybe that makes it in.